Tom Wood Show, episode 1729.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
A lot of our people complain that the Pentagon spends and wastes a lot of money, but the damage it does to the American economy and to American society is much greater than just that. It deforms the economy in ways most people don't even realize. Get the full story in my free ebook, The Pentagon Versus the Economy. Pick it up at militaryeconomy.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Delighted to welcome back to the show Sheldon Richman, who has done many, many things in the libertarian world over the course of his life. He's edited The Freeman, published by the Foundation for Economic Education. He's written many books, and we've talked about a couple of them in the past. We're talking today about his brand new book, What Social Animals Owe to Each Other. And he, of course, runs the Libertarian Institute with Scott Horton, and I sit on the board of the Libertarian Institute. Sheldon, welcome back.
Great to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm looking at this title, and of course, I, being a libertarian nerd, immediately thought of the William Graham Sumner book, What Social Classes Owe to Each Other. Yeah. Was there some commonality with that book that made you?
No, actually, no. I'd read the book. It's a collection of essays. And I don't know, maybe he says a few things in there that I repeat, but it wasn't intentional. I do have one article in that one chapter in that book that deals with builds on a quote by Sumner about the banking finance power. But it just occurred to me that what I wrote over those years in compiling and writing these essays that then got compiled into the book, it's about social animals and what they owe each other, and a large part of it is. And I knew that title, so I thought, I like the idea of echoing that title. I'm really pleased I came up with that idea.
Yeah, I like it too. So what I want to do with this book, because it's got so much material on so many topics, that I think I might want to just milk this baby for all it's worth, as many Tom Woods Show episodes I can wring out of this thing. Because as I went through, I could see that it's not just slapdash. You've arranged it in a way that's thematic and makes sense. And in particular, maybe the first 10 chapters or so are really, truly foundational about why we believe what we believe and what the foundations of that are. And there's controversy among libertarians, of course, as how do we ground what we believe in? You know, do we ground it this way, using that sort of argument, that sort of argument? And you make a repeated reference to Roderick Long and his Aristotelian approach to this. So this is a very, very rich 10 chapters. So I think I'm just going to, as I mentioned before we started recording, I'm going to hone in on those, especially because I think you have a unique take on it. And I'd like to just pick your brain a little bit on some of this stuff, because even I sometimes feel, you know, I'm not even sure how convincing I sound sometimes when it gets to fundamental things. Because that's the real problem is first principles. Once you get those first principles and you're really committed to them, then an awful lot does follow. So the real question is, how do we persuade people of those first principles, especially when there are people who have different first principles who can defend them. Like, first of all, frankly, I'm sorry I'm talking too much, but anarcho-communists can actually defend their position on property in a way that is not immediately ridiculous sounding. You know, I think some libertarians don't realize that. They think, well, we're just obviously correct. Well, if you debate a really smart one of those guys, it's a little bit murkier than you think. So let's just start off with the idea of non-aggression, because that's where you start.
Yeah.
And you describe it, interestingly, not as just leave people alone, but you describe it as an obligation. That non-aggression is a kind of obligation that we share.
That's true. I mean, it's been over the years, it's been called the non-aggression principle, right? The NAP, the non-aggression axiom. Murray Rothbard, who I knew and was mightily influenced by over the years, called it the non-aggression axiom. I guess it's been called other things too. But as I was writing that piece, and that's the title piece, I believe, right? What Social Animals Owe to Each Other.
Yes.
Which then the whole book got its title from. It occurred to me as we were going, given my take on this, that it was more than just a principle or an axiom, but it actually was it's an obligation. And I tried to set out why I think it's that. I'll say quickly, just to preface all this, is that I'm an Aristotelian, and I have been for a long time. And I think my thinking about Aristotle has been heavily focused or substantially focused over many years now by Roderick Long's work on Aristotle and relating it to libertarianism. When I talk about Aristotle now, I mean the ethics, not the politics, right? Because the Greek politics were often not very good, as we know from Plato's Republic. But if you're looking at the ethics itself and discussing human beings as social animals and political animals, using political in a very broad sense, then that fits very nicely. And of course, Roderick's not the first to say this either. There are other libertarians of today who have used Aristotle's foundations to get to our form of liberalism.
There's some interesting work by a fellow named Fred Miller.
Yes.
Maybe he was at Bowling Green, and elaborating on this and trying to position Aristotle in some broad sense as being within our tradition.
No, that's right. Fred Miller's book came out years ago, many years ago, and that's one of the first names that would have come to mind about how can Aristotle kind of serve the purposes of forming a very solid libertarian foundation. And I appreciate that. Others have done this. Douglas Denial and his co-author Douglas Rasmussen, the two Dougs, as they're sometimes called, they certainly write in the Aristotelian tradition. There's differences among all these authors. And Roderick's been doing it most recently in a very interesting way. The interesting thing is it's in the context of his showing that Aristotle was better than Ayn Rand. And I quote that essay of his. It's available as a booklet. Originally appeared at the Journal of the Institute for Objectivist Studies some years ago, and it's wonderful because it's such a great elaboration of Aristotle's views on, and he does this in other places too, but views on how we can acquire real knowledge of the world and also what is the nature of human beings, of the human animal. That I think you get as Roderick does, you get a fantastic foundation for libertarianism.
Well, Aristotle is concerned with, among other things, human flourishing and what sorts of things that a human being does either contribute to his flourishing or detract from it. And Roderick then links, and then you, elaborating on this, link this idea of human flourishing to, well, I don't want to give it all away because I think it's beautifully laid out. How do we connect human flourishing, properly understood, with a libertarian political view?
Well, I think what you find in Aristotle, and again, Roderick, I hope I don't mention his name too many times. It's going to sound like you should have had Roderick Long on. he shows that this idea of flourishing is a very, very rich idea. And he contrasts it with Rand's approach, although Rand's approach is inconsistent and muddled. But a big part of Rand's approach is not the focus on flourishing, but the focus on survival, right? Mere survival, which is very different. That's very thin. Flourishing is very thick. So what you can get out of Aristotle is the way we flourish, since our essential nature as human beings is reason, language, and language. We're reasoning and language using animals, that the way we achieve excellence, and the way Aristotle talked about virtue and excellence, developing the virtues, the way you achieve excellence and therefore aim at happiness and the good life, a lot of words are used for this, is through dealing with people through reason. In other words, we flourish. Number one, we need to be in communities. That's what it means to be a social animal. And we need to deal with people through rational means, which means reason, language, persuasion, and that rules out force. Now, I'm not saying Aristotle extended that and saw that, although there are hints of it. But the point is, it doesn't matter what the original thinker thinks. He could easily miss some interpretation or implication of his own view. And so it's open to later thinkers to come along and say, this great early thinker missed a very important consequence of his own thought. So that's perfectly valid too. So I think you get a very firm foundation for libertarian out of this. You get interpersonal ethics from personal ethics. And one thing I should point out, again, to cite Aristotle. Aristotle is very clear early in the Nicomachean Ethics that the kinds of proof you find in one discipline are going to differ from the degree of proof that you're going to find in other disciplines. So you don't expect to find, say, in ethics or politics, the kinds of rigid, really rigorous sorts of demonstrations that you find in mathematics or the hard sciences. It's because it's a different animal. And so you shouldn't be looking for mathematical proofs. In other words, there's lots to argue about. I can't offer a knockdown, nobody can say anything back to me, a proof of these things. But I think we can invoke a lot of plausibility and just sort of, there's a common sense element to this. And I think that's what I tried to do.
Well, in particular with the way you're framing it, it seems even more ridiculous that we have to deal with a misconception coming from, let's say, traditionalist type people mm-hmm. and from, let's say, you know, left-wing social Democrats who both come together to say that we believe in atomized individuals. Yeah. You know, we don't believe in society or we don't believe in tradition or whatever. We just believe in isolated individuals. But everything you've just described involves interpersonal relationships.
Exactly. So the people on the left that talk the way you're now saying either are ignorant, which doesn't speak very well of them. It means they haven't read in the liberal tradition, the very rich liberal tradition dating back hundreds of years. Or they're dishonest. I'm not sure I can think of a third alternative, and I'm not sure which is more flattering to them, especially when the ones that hold themselves out as scholars, because it's ridiculous to paint as the sort of the ideal libertarian Ted Kaczynski without the letter bombs, right? The guy living in a shed or a shack in where was he, Montana, off the grid, no electricity, self sufficient, never seeing anybody apparently. That can't be the ideal. And it's so obvious. It's not like a subtle point that a critic of libertarianism could overlook. All you need to do is read Ludwig von Mises. I talk quite a bit about von Mises in this book. You know, you don't have to go far in the libertarian literature or go deeply into the scholarly academic stuff to see libertarians lauding the division of labor. Okay, Adam Smith. The book talks about the division of labor being so important. Well, I guarantee you that Ted Kaczynski wasn't engaged in the division of labor. That takes cooperation. That takes other people. Mm-hmm. And so that's a start, at least. It's not the full case for this social, the importance of social existence and the need for society to flourish, in which to flourish. But it's certainly, it's a very good start. You need people to divide the labor with and trade. So it's just so superficial to say libertarians are atomistic individualists. So my answer to that is twofold. I mean, the first term I came up with to counter that was, no, we're molecular individualists because we have all kinds of ties to other people. But then one I came up with after the book, or maybe I hadn't done an article on it related to this, so there was nothing to put in the book about this. But I'm a big fan of Adam Smith in a lot of ways. And so I'll happily accept the designation atomistic individualist, but I spell it A-D-A-M-I-S-T-I-C. So in that sense, I'm an atomistic individualist. Great.
Fair enough. Now, you have a couple of chapters in here in which the very title of the chapter includes the word social cooperation. You point out that Ludwig von Mises' book, Human Action, was originally intended to be called Social Cooperation. And I have to admit, although I understand why he called it Human Action, part of me wishes he had called it Social Cooperation, because it would have forced the other side to acknowledge if one of our great treatises is called Social Cooperation, you have to reckon with what we are talking about.
No, I agree. And I made this guess that I guess that the second most commonly used phrase in that, 700, 800 page book is social cooperation. Second only to the term division of labor. Now, for some reason, I didn't think at the time that private property would have been a contender also, but it didn't occur to me. So later on, a friend of mine ran the text through one of those the software things that count the phrases, and he said I was right. Social cooperation second, division of labor, which is another way of saying social cooperation, maybe a little slightly more focused. Social cooperation would be a little more general. That was first, and social cooperation is second. But I share your view. Think, who knows? The history of the second half of the 20th century and into this century might have been very different, certainly for the libertarian movement, if one of our favorite books was called Social Cooperation.
Well, how do we get through to people, though, who look at what they think is the market and they think they understand it, and what they see is nothing but competition, right? It's one firm competing against another, right? And the other firm loses, and those people lose their jobs. They would say, how naive can you be to describe that right. In any way as being cooperation? How do you answer that?
Well, I deal with that in a few places in the book. That anticipates a later chapter beyond the section you're talking about, where I say that a lot of people, I get the feeling that a lot of people's objection to the market is not ethical or historical or economic, but aesthetic. Some people who probably, you know, I'm sure, think of themselves on the left, think of the market as ugly. And because they think the components of it are ugly, and competition is one of those. And the mistake they make is to assume the opposite of competition is cooperation. Cooperation sounds warm and fuzzy. Competition is what? Quote, cutthroat, right? Dog eat dog. It's ugly. Cooperation's nice. Oh, kumbaya. We all get together around the campfire and sing songs. And then the next day we all cooperate. I try to point out there are two sides of the same coin. Look, I walk into a shopping mall, not these days because of the pandemic. I walk in the shopping mall and need shoes. I see in the shopping mall three shoe stores. Okay, what's going on there? Well, I'm going into the shopping mall to cooperate with somebody in order to get shoes. I'm not a shoemaker, so I got to cooperate with someone to get shoes. There are three sellers in there, each vying to cooperate with me, to be the one. I'm only going to buy one pair, so you know I got to pick one store out. Now, the relationship among the three of them, we can call competition. One of them is going to win the sale, and two are going to not win the sale. But what they're competing to do is what? Cooperate with me. So competition is merely part of my being free to decide with whom I wish to cooperate. It really is that simple. The alternative would be some sort of compulsory cooperation, but that doesn't sound so warm and fuzzy anymore, does it? Forced cooperation, where I'm told, I mean, think of some of the totalitarian regimes of the past, where I'm told with whom I'm going to, quote, cooperate. That doesn't look aesthetically, that's not as aesthetically pleasing as when we typically think of the word cooperation. So they're the two sides of the same coin. And the other thing, what keeps the competitors honest with respect to me is themselves, right? Because one is ready to check the other by saying, I have a better product, I have a lower price, whatever. So if they're free, and they get no privileges from the state in any way, then they check each other, which is the benefit to me, right? The potential cooperator.
Everybody, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, Hydrant. Now, I just went on, this very week, my first hike ever in my entire life. Can you imagine Tom Woods hiking? I'm in South Dakota this week, enjoying the free state of South Dakota. And when I started my day, I started with Hydrant. If you wait till you feel thirsty, it's too late. You're already dehydrated. And you know drinking water has all kinds of great health effects. And Hydrant makes it easy. It's a refreshing electrolyte powder you mix directly into water, more efficiently and effectively hydrates your body, keeps you going for longer. Each rapid hydration mix has the four essential electrolytes your body needs, sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc, and it really packs a punch. Comes in a variety of flavors. These days, my favorite is iced tea lemonade, but also if there's fruit punch, blood orange, and more. Refreshing and delicious, and I feel great after. Try it for yourself. See what I'm talking about. Tastes incredible, and it works. We've got a special deal for our listeners to save 25% off your first order. Go to drinkhydrant.com/woods or enter our promo code WOODS at checkout. That's drinkhydrant.com/woods and enter promo code WOODS for 25% off your first order. drinkhydrant.com/woods and enter promo code WOODS to save 25%. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. All right, I'm going to switch gears entirely because I want to make sure that we get to all the topics that I selfishly desire be covered. And one of them involves an exchange you had with somebody, a non-libertarian, who thought that you had involved yourself in circular reasoning, or you were kind of begging the question, because he's saying that libertarians say they believe in non-aggression. But look, suppose I'm just walking around on some land that some libertarian claims has come into his ownership. But I'm not physically aggressing against anybody. I'm just having a peaceful walk. And he thinks he can use aggression against me. Well, that goes to show libertarians are themselves the initiators of aggression in many cases. And so it all just comes down to definitions. It's not a clear-cut case of they're the good guys and we're the bad, terrible invaders and so on and so forth. I may not be framing that debate exactly the right way, but maybe you can help me out in how you responded.
That was part of the objection, and you hear this. Other people have said this over the years against this idea of private property that isn't the aggressor the person that the libertarian says is the defender. So, look, let me say right up front, like Murray Rothbard and other people, Mark Roderick Long, there is a rule regarding if you're using force, and for the moment, let's accept that it's defensive force. If you're using defensive force, it has to be proportional to what's, you know, the aggression against you. And so some minor thing like someone crossing the corner of your property as a shortcut, you can't shoot, you know, you can't shoot that guy under, I think, a very reasonable application of libertarian natural law, natural rights. You know, you can warn the person and you can put up a fence if it's really, you know, you don't want that happening. So this critic sort of left the impression that libertarians think that, you know, if about to step on your toe, you can blow them away. That's just ridiculous. And I, you know, defy this person to name a libertarian who took any such position. The point about property, though, relates again to ourselves as rational social beings. I mean, one of the things rational social beings need to do to flourish, if we're flourishing, is to engage in what's been called, you know, simply projects throughout our lives. A career would be an example of it, setting up a family, et cetera, all kinds of things, huge, infinite variations. But to be able to do that in a secure way, you need to be able to control some physical things. I mean, you need a place to stand, to sleep, to live, to eat. And if all that, you know, if you had no rights to that, no valid claim to that, and no valid right to repel someone who wants to take it away from you or interfere with that, then what happens to flourishing? It goes down the drain. I don't have that text right in front of me, but later in that chapter, when I engaged with this fellow on Twitter, I think, somewhere, Facebook, Twitter, and he couldn't answer whether when a woman is repelling a rapist, whether she was an aggressor. Why wasn't she the aggressor? I mean, her body, you know, the first property is your body, right? Slave owners and slave traders were called appropriately by the abolitionists man stealers.
Yeah.
That kind of says it all. That's right, because the first property right is in yourself. Of course, Murray Rothbard used this image quite a bit, that you know, self-ownership, very important. I think a good way to state what we're getting at here. And so why do you own yourself? I mean, I applied this critic's logic to the first property right. And he wouldn't answer me when I said, so I suppose that, you know, that a woman who repels a rapist is, maybe she's the aggressor. And he didn't respond. And I think I really caught him.
Yeah, that is a good one. That is a good one. Because what is he going to say? Because I bet he hadn't thought in those terms before. I don't think they think about the individual and self-ownership all that much. So I think when you raise objections like this, people...
Because they don't want to... You know, I'm sure he considers himself an advocate of human rights, right? Because who would say, I'm not an advocate of human rights? Everybody
right.
Human rights. But he can't make the concession that it begins with self-ownership because, number one, they don't like that O word, right? That horrible multi-syllabic O word, ownership. Because I think they realize that for them, it's a slippery slope.
Oh, yeah, they're going to accidentally back into libertarianism if they're not careful.
That's right, and I don't see how you avoid that. I mean, why do you own yourself, but you don't own you know, the food you either grew or you engaged in an exchange, right, got the food from somebody? Why don't you own that? Why can't someone come along and take it? It's just like why isn't it crossing somebody's property? I don't see how it differs. And so I think they fear that, and they don't have a foundation for human rights, right? The non-libertarians, because they're afraid of it. If they have it, so yeah, I think it just collapses. And
but what they're basically afraid of is that it'll turn out that those rights are far more expansive than they're willing to admit. They want some human rights, but let's be reasonable here.
You know, I'm not a huge fan of Abraham Lincoln in most respects. I don't think you are either. But you know, he famously said, "If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong." I think that's a very good line.
Yeah.
It reminds me of H.L. Mencken's line, I don't like slavery because I don't like slaves. Not quite the same line, but if what's the corollary of Lincoln's saying, which I don't think he may or may not would or would not have accepted. If it's correct to say if slavery's not wrong, nothing is wrong, then I say if self-ownership isn't right, then nothing is right.
Yeah.
And I don't see how you can attack that if you're going to accept the Lincoln point. And if somebody wants to reject Lincoln's point, let them have it. Go. Let me hear it.
Now, I'm perfectly happy to respond to critics like the one you addressed because, you know, I'm glad to explain myself. And sometimes it helps me to learn how to explain things better. Mm-hmm. I understand it more deeply. I'm very happy with that. But there's a part of me that thinks that in a way, we shouldn't necessarily always be the ones on the defensive, that there should be a kind of presumption in favor of our view, mm-hmm. because really what our view amounts to is maybe what we would call, and you know what, maybe I'm stealing a phrase from Roderick Long at this point. I don't know where I got this, but it sounds like a Roderick expression. We believe in like a functional egalitarianism in the sense that there's no obvious reason that any one of us should have more power over others than any other one of us. That is to say, nobody's born with a letter on the forehead that says, okay, you can tax and regulate and imprison, but you can't. And so it seems to me that the burden is on non-libertarians to show me why, given that as I look around the human race, I don't see any natural indication that one person or one group of people is naturally meant to lord it over others. Where does that come from? Why would the presumption not be equality in that sense?
Exactly. And Roderick Long has an article on this, which I'm sure you can find online, called Equality, the Other Ideal, kind of echoing Rand's Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, or the Other Unknown Ideal. I forget exactly how he put it. I got him to write a version of that for the Freeman when I was the editor of the Freeman. And his point there was, you know, everybody says they're for equality, but okay, equality is different ways of interpreting that word equality. So equality in before the law is one of the common ways. But he said, you know, that may not be a good thing. If it's bad law, we're all equal in front of a bad law. You know, that's not good.
Yeah.
You think of the draft right. where women weren't drafted. Now, the answer wasn't draft women. It was the
right
drafting men, although some people said draft women. Another one would be equal freedom, equality of freedom. But what if everybody's equal with a little bit of freedom? We all have the same quote amount, not that you can quantify it. But so that doesn't work either. So he reaches back to John Locke, who talked about equality of authority. And that's good, solid liberalism. And again, in the libertarian sense, if we all are equal in authority, and it doesn't just mean that everybody's equal before the judge, as Roderick puts it, but we're equal to the judge. Nobody has superior authority over anybody else. And that's true equality. And I think that's a very nice way to put it.
And that can't be changed simply because a bunch of these equal people got together and decided right. that they're going to appoint certain others to have magical powers. Where does this come from? I think these are, and not to say that there couldn't possibly be a response. I just think a lot of people don't think this fundamentally. I don't think they look into it that deeply. They like the way things are set up. Right. They don't ask fundamental questions. Where does this come from? And somebody who's been really good on things like this, and he attacks it from a different angle than usual, is Michael Humer at the University of Colorado Boulder. Because his book, The Problem of Political Authority, I really think is one of the best contributions in a long time to our literature, because a lot of what he argues is not coming from, let's say, the traditional natural rights view, but really just kind of, I don't know, like common moral intuitions that everybody shares. That, like, if I go out to dinner with 9 friends and they vote that I have to pay for the dinner, we all recognize that's illegitimate. Mm-hmm. You know, so how does that change just because it's people with suits and ties and a ballot box and a lever?
No, that's true. That's a very good book. It's a very nice approach. He says, you know, we don't need to defend liberty on the basis of liberty is already controversial, certainly in the way we talk about it. So it doesn't.
Right.
Maybe it doesn't help to defend liberty on the basis of even more controversial premises.
Exactly.
So no, he's a very smart guy and a very good writer, and I like that book a lot. And he actually is drawing on, I don't know if he did this intentionally, but he's drawing on a point made by Bastiat in the first half of the 19th century, the great liberal economist in France, who pointed out that you know, no group can have a right to do something that no member of the group has the right to do. So getting together doesn't give the group more new rights. So, which is a way of, you know, yanking the rug out from democracy, right? You can't say, well, 50% plus one said we can do this, so therefore we can do it to the, you know, to the minority. No, it doesn't work. You can't add up a bunch of zeros put together doesn't equal anything more than zero.
Right. You know, I'm looking at the, I don't know where the heck this episode went. It seems like we just sat down. We're already finished. Well, all right, first of all, to heck with Michael Humer for a minute. We want to promote Sheldon Richman. Okay, because you should be reading. This is a great book from the Libertarian Institute, What Social Animals Owe to Each Other. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1729. But could I get you back on sooner rather than later to dig deeper into this thing? Because this is a ton of fun.
Yeah.
And I think we're in effect not only giving people a reading assignment of this book, but I think as they go through, they're going to think, you know, I should check out this and this and this, and they're going to be better people. And that's what we're here for. So thank you for your time today, Sheldon.
I'm at your beck and call. Thank you for inviting me.
All right, that's going to do it for today. I've got some juicy episodes this week. I'm really looking forward to this week and next. I've lined up some good guests and good topics for you. And of course, if you're not on the old Woods mailing list, well, then you're the only people in the libertarian world who aren't. And that wouldn't that be a shame to be the only person out there not on the Woods mailing list, in particular because it's just so darn good. It's the only place I write really anymore. You search in vain for my articles. I just write them for my good subscribers out there. So hop on board over at wrongaboutlockdown.com. That's where you get one of my free ebooks, and you will enjoy the commentary, trust me. So go ahead and do that, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.